Moncrief on News Talk
with Gas Networks Ireland. Natural gas is compatible with a wide range of modern appliances. gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.
Now, normally at this stage of the show, we play a few random or odd or interesting clips that we find around the place. But given that it is this time of the year, we've put together this small montage of what was, by any definition, a highly eventful year.
This American carnage stops right here and stops right now.
This was the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, period, both in person and around the globe.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture. This is not a joke. Moonlight has won Best Picture. Moonlight, Best Picture.
Got some news coming into us. Greater Manchester Police have warned people to stay away from Manchester Arena as officers respond to what they're describing as an incident of some kind of explosion.
Harvey Weinstein has opened the floodgates, with women across the country and across industries coming forward to share their stories of sexual assault and harassment.
This is the moment I've waited for 4 years. You know, a free man, I quit it after 4 years. I've still left a lot of cellmates behind. There's still a lot of innocent people behind, you know, behind bars around the world, not just in Egypt.
I could barely let you finish proposing. I said, can I say yes now?
She didn't even let me finish. She said, can I say yes, can I say yes now? And then there was hugs and I had the ring in my finger. And
jolly good stuff. So to discuss some of these events, we're joined by special correspondent with the Irish Independent, Seán Murray, and freelance writer Amy O'Connor. Amy and Seán, good afternoon to you.
Afternoon.
Afternoon, Seán.
Now, I suppose we might as well start with the person we can't avoid mentioning, that being Trump. And Seán, you've chosen the lies at the inauguration out of the dozens of lies. Why did you start with that one?
I started because it's the start of a very turbulent year in international politics and American politics. And it started off with something that was just so gravely inaccurate for any normal person with a brain or eyes to see, which was, of course, the figures at the inauguration in January of Donald Trump. And you had the first glimpse of blistering Sean Spicer demanding that the media was inaccurate, and in actual fact, those photos, which blatantly showed a comparison or contrast between Barack Obama's inauguration figures and Donald Trump's, they were paltry in comparison. But you had people like Sean Spicer saying the media is getting this wrong. We had the biggest inauguration figures in the history of any presidential inauguration. And that was really, to me, even, you know, the speech that he gave at the inauguration and all the other things since then, it sort of started from there, because how could they possibly say that these were the biggest inauguration figures? I think the comparison is about 1.8 million people showed up for Obama, and they don't have obviously official exact figures, and something like less than a third for Trump. But if you look at the aerial photograph, it's so blatantly true.
Yeah.
There were fewer people there. And then after that, we had, of course, the speech from Donald Trump, which was just a dystopian. He's talking about the worst parts of American society, drug abuse, unemployment, when in actual fact he was taking over as president in one of the most remarkable recovery periods ever. When Obama took over, you had 8 years of a disastrous war, you had a tanking economy, you had a banking crisis, Americans losing their jobs in the thousands, and a deeply unpopular president. So America was actually quite divided then. Obama took over and his speech was much more optimistic. Trump takes over at a time when the economy, unemployment is actually, it's almost at full employment. The economy is growing. Things are actually looking up, but America's divisive, and he decides to focus on, graveyards and catastrophe. And he kind of, his speech was about authoritarianism rather than anything else, and it was quite dystopian. So that was just the start of it. And then, as we've seen, the past year has been really quite difficult to watch. At times, I find it actually quite difficult to even have to observe the things that Donald Trump says and does.
Yeah, I suppose what was interesting about Spicer's reaction to the inauguration figures was that probably there was a hope among the press corps, especially the press corps that covers the White House, was that, well, he's just doing this for the election. When he becomes president, he'll become more responsible. But then it turned out, no, this is the way it's going to be now.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Built on lies. Everybody was hoping for that moment where he became a statesman. He was no longer candidate Trump. He was presidential Trump. And that's why the speech was so disappointing, because there was nothing unifying in it at all. It was constantly dividing, and he was having a go at Barack Obama in it and Washington DC and the elite and then Sean Spicer then demanding that the press were against again lying. And then as we said, days later, Donald Trump went to speak to the CIA and the intelligence community. And it was supposed to be a time where he's going to reconcile his, you know, abuse towards him, which he had engaged in during the campaign. And he was also there for a monument for the fallen heroes of the intelligence world in America. Instead, he actually used his speech to condemn the media. And people were disgusted, outraged. The former head of the CIA and John Brennan came out and said, this is really disgusting tactics from this new president. And we've seen it just sort of, you know, got worse and worse over the past 12 months.
Yeah, I think probably at the time a lot of people were wondering, is this a tactic or is he just mad?
Yeah, it's so funny when Shona is saying that because it genuinely feels like about 10 years ago that happened.
Yes.
Like just given everything that's happened this year, where you're looking at Spicer, you're looking at Scaramucci, you're looking at all these, like Kellyanne Conway, all these wild characters that have come out of the Trump White House. And it's so hard to, because it happens at such a rapid pace, it's hard to even think of like, did that happen? When did that happen? And you forget about all the stuff that happened this year. But I think, yeah, you're right. I think there had been a hope that, like you said, it was all kind of a front for the campaign and that he'd go in and maybe he'd almost be let the other kind of, you know, the likes of Reince Priebus and stuff actually kind of dictate policy. But that hasn't happened at all. And if anything, he's gotten much worse and much more deluded. I mean, I think recently, obviously, he's been denying that that was him on the Access Hollywood tape. And you're like, whoa, I mean, this guy really knows no bounds when it comes to just telling blatant lies.
As we've seen, it's not even just the lies. It's also the things like, you know, his support for white nationalists. The fact that he, you know, unnecessarily decided that transgender people would be disqualified from the military. These are people who have actually given up their lives and are willing to spend their lives in the military at the front line or whatever part, and suddenly starts to disqualify them for no apparent reason. You know, there's been just a litany of things that are so deeply offensive and divisive. His United Nations speech was a foreign policy version of his inauguration speech. Saying things like, you know, bellicose statements to someone in North Korea, calling him Rocket Man, and denigrating the United Nations, which for all its faults was something that was set up because of the genocide in Germany in the Second World War, which does have its strong points. Just his isolationist policy and his treatment of people like, you know, Angela Merkel in favour of someone like Vladimir Putin. It's really just goes on and on. And, you know, his treatment towards, like we saw in Charlottesville, where he supported, you know, white nationalists and the death of, he didn't initially condemn, you know, the death of a left-wing protester. Roy Moore, a paedophile, and the man, the President of the United States.
Alleged paedophile.
Well, okay, alleged paedophile. But okay, he's definitely, there is a lot of evidence against him. There are people who, you know, who can prove on certain occasions that he had a relationship with them. And we've seen written documentation where he sent one of the girls a card, or he wrote on her high school album or annual. And yet he pretended he'd never known who she was. And even still, just the idea that somebody like that you could support and vouch for to be in part of your administration. How is that not in any way questionable? His removal from the United States from the climate change accords from Paris. Just the list goes on and on. There is no end to how destructive he is.
The documentary that Channel 4 broadcast during the year about Trump was, I thought, was very revealing. One particular episode that they were talking about Jesse Ventura, who was a former wrestler, but then ran for the governorship of a state. And Trump went to visit him. Now, this is many years ago, but Jesse Ventura's strategy was to, one of his strategies was to attack the media. And Trump went down there specifically to find out, how did you do it? And he toyed with the Reform Party very briefly, but it seems as if he had no intention. But it's very interesting, those parallels. So perhaps we can take from that that he's not nuts, that this is a deliberate strategy of doing it, because it destabilizes everything, and especially for the media, it knocks people off kilter all the time, to the point now where we've almost become so inured to it that it's the new normal.
It is nuts. It's just that this is a tactic that he's adopted, but that doesn't mean that he's not nuts. It's not that he's somehow incredibly intelligent and cunning.
Well, there's cunning. I'll give him cunning.
Okay, cunning, right, but not highly intelligent. This is quite simplistic stuff, and of course, we're probably worse for buying into it, but you're right, because it's very clear that he is distracting the media on several occasions. Like when it came to even the transgender stuff, you know, and even and I know we're going to talk about it, the agreement to recognise Jerusalem as the capital of Israel comes just as a time when people are being, for more and more people are being indicted from his team during the Mueller administration, and then he deflects and he cut in, and everybody has to return to this Jerusalem issue, and the media is covering that, and he's doing a really good job of it, and so nobody can dig deep on it. Well, they can, but not fewer journalists can dig deep on the matters that are actually important and consequential, while he's just sort of throwing these balls all over the place.
Anyway, as we all know, Donald Trump has never touched a woman inappropriately, or has always treated them with respect at all times. And the, probably the Access Hollywood tape is a total fabrication. Unlike Harvey Weinstein et al., which has had a huge effect, not just in the industry, but, you know, in a greater sense because of the Me Too campaign, which has spread all over the world.
Yeah, so, I mean, the Me Too campaign, it kind of kicked off, I suppose, after the revelations about Harvey Weinstein, which is that he seems to just have, you know, been a really serial sexual predator for many, many years. People like Salma Hayek, Lupita Nyong'o, Ashley Judge, Gwyneth Paltrow, Angelina Jolie, they've all come out with allegations against him, and it sparked a really wide-ranging conversation about men in not only the arts and entertainment and media, but across, you know, politics, and, you know, we've seen like people like chefs and stuff getting taken down in the last couple of weeks. And I don't think this moment actually could have really happened without Donald Trump, because I think we kicked off the year the day after his inauguration. We had the Women's March, and there was a real kind of feeling of almost like an uprising, I feel like, against Donald Trump, because and what he stood for. You know, he was a misogynist. You know, he said deeply disrespectful things about Hillary Clinton, you know, Megyn Kelly, and people were kind of sick of it. And I think it kind of spurred on journalists to look into, you know, allegations that were maybe kind of laying low for many, many years and that they couldn't prove. And I think since then, you know, you've had people like Kevin Spacey, Dustin Hoffman, Al Franken, Matt Lauer, the list goes on. And it just seems to have been, it's just a moment where I think women feel empowered to actually talk about how men have been allowed to behave, and how, you know, these issues that have gone unchallenged by the establishment and by men and women. I think we're opening men's eyes to what's going on and what has happened to women for many, many years. But I don't think it could have happened without Trump.
And is it a change just in specific industries, or hopefully a change in society in general? Is this a cultural problem?
Well, it's definitely a cultural problem, and it's obviously not, it's not limited to the arts and the media and entertainment or politics or anything like that. But I think maybe the conversations had to start there, because you have powerful women coming out saying we've been the victim of this, and I think that empowers, you know, women like myself, my friends, to have conversations about, you know, how men have treated us in the past and what we've kind of had to contend with, whether it's, you know, relatively minor stuff like unwanted groping or stalking or sexual assault. So I think it is a cultural moment, and it's prompted a conversation. Obviously, at the moment, it is kind of relegated to, you know, the likes of Harvey Weinstein, Dustin Hoffman, the men that we all know. But I think that it has started a wider, broader conversation. I think in the new year, I think it's a moment of reckoning, and I think it will hopefully continue on in the new year.
Yeah, because there still seems to be a lot of concentration on what Hollywood types are saying about it. And last week there, Matt Damon was going, oh, well, you know, most men don't grope women, as if they should deserve a medal for that. There's a sense that there are people who still don't get this yet, what this means.
Yeah, I mean, there isn't at all. But I think at the moment, what I hope doesn't happen is that we get kind of immune to all the allegations. That it's just that we don't get like, oh yeah, sure, men are all the same, and that we don't learn anything from it. That's what I'm kind of, that's what I hope doesn't happen. I hope it doesn't reach a plateau. But I do think that men are getting more of a sense of what was going on. I mean, I know just even among my own male friends, they're horrified at some of the stuff that has come out, particularly about Harvey Weinstein, but also men in other industries that maybe you would never have had any suspicions about, you know?
Yeah, and I suppose the things that make headlines are the most gross examples of it. But what people who aren't high profile people, you know, ordinary men and women, that it's difficult for a man, I'm a man, I don't really know what it's like to be a woman walking down the street.
Yeah.
And what that feels like, and what that, you know, what you're subjected to, you know, looks or calls or even, you know, that sense of feeling like you have to be self-conscious. I'm putting words in your mouth.
Yeah,
here.
Insecurity. Yeah. I mean, that happens to you, where you feel totally self-conscious for no reason, because just guys might be, you know, staring at you or just shout something. And it's not even just about that. It's about, like, I hope what you're saying is true, that it is a moment of reckoning. But I also find that there are people who are resistant to it and maybe see it as this sort of extreme feminist movement as well, where men are coming under attack and they're coming under attack in their droves. And the Me Too thing is, it's this sort of targeting of men. Mm-hmm. And there has to be a conversation about facts and about evidence as well, because obviously you want to make sure that people aren't accused in the wrong. But I know that it is I know a friend of mine was raped 5 years ago, and she said she finds this really supportive. Mm-hmm. And she didn't ask for it. But it just emerged, and she finds herself among people who now she knows that she wasn't sort of, you know, she always had that same thing where she felt that she was to blame. And she finds this whole thing great. But then I've other friends, we were talking about it at a dinner party, who came out and said she doesn't like the Me Too thing because she thinks, again, it's just aggressive feminism. And what you're doing is you're isolating the good men, and that men feel like, oh, and then there's you hear other sort of narratives like, well, God, if you can't flirt with a woman, I don't know, you know what? if the day comes when you can't have a bit of a flirt, then, you know, I don't know what the world's coming to.
Yeah.
Which is a total misinterpretation of what it is to flirt or have a conversation.
That argument has driven me crazy, because it's like all the stories that have come out, none of it remotely resembles flirting. You know what I mean? So this isn't like, that isn't what the issue is here. It's not about oh God, a man can't wink at you anymore. That isn't what the issue is. You know, it's much more sinister, much more violent, much more aggressive. And I think that's what the conversation is about. Yeah.
And it's about, it's pervasive as well. It's really about male environments, you know, and in workplaces I've been in, you know, over the years, even here's one example, the doll, okay? The night of the discussion of the life during pregnancy bill, a male TD, you know, spanked a female TD in the night of that. That is, I know we're kind of sniggering, but that's...
No, it's madness.
Absolutely outrageous. And not only, like, ironically, the legislation that was being passed was about women's healthcare, but, you know... And like, okay, everyone found it outrageous, like repugnant. But nonetheless, somebody felt that that was a thing to do, whether he was drunk or not. I don't know. It doesn't matter. But the point, it's that kind of pervasive stuff where you
exactly
think, you know, sure, how are you girls? And you're looking gorgeous. There's nothing wrong with even people coming, but sometimes it's just women are seen as something to be objectified at times. And obviously it is only a joke, but sometimes it just gets a bit more extreme. And that's one of the sort of culminations of that.
Wait, then do we need to start in schools teaching people common sense? Because it just strikes me that is common sense. There's a difference between flirting and dropping the hand on someone.
And there's consent, which also, universities are talking about teaching young men about. But I remember Ricky Gervais used to have this sort of sketch, and it was about the NHS had this program about for young boys in schools, and it was to teach them not to rape. And he was like, how has it come to the point where we have to teach men not to rape? And that makes it sound like, you know, in the UK there's just, you know, hordes of men raping women, because it's not. And even though there are, that does exist in some cultures. But it was just like, I mean, do we have to do that? Perhaps we do. Perhaps the whole thing needs to sort of restart again.
Well, I think there definitely needs to be a conversation had in schools, because I know myself in school, there was never a conversation about consent or anything to do with sex even. You know, it was real just kind of very biological. This goes here, that goes there. Like, you know, you might get pregnant. That was it. There was no discussion about things like consent or what's unwanted or how to treat people with respect. And I think it's the key word is respect. And I think that kind of needs to be taught to guys from a young age, I would say.
Meanwhile, in other parts of the world, the caliphate is over, or is it?
Long live the caliphate. I think, you know, I suppose the pretenses of a state no longer exists. So, and this is because the Iraqi Prime Minister Abadi has come out and, you know, sort of said ISIS no longer exists in Iraq anymore. And it's kind of reminded me of that in 2003, George Bush in Iraq, mission accomplished, signed behind him. And meanwhile, all around him, literally everywhere, the place there was burning infernos. You know? And like, so this is what it kind of reminds me of. The interpretation is really, very base, that you have gotten rid of ISIS in Iraq. You know, first of all, ISIS has been around since 2000, 2003. They went underground in 2006. So we know already as a group, that's what they tend to do. So if they were sort of disappearing for a short while, the likelihood is, guys, they're somewhere, you know, regrouping. So that's the first thing. The second thing is Abadi's going into an election soon. So he obviously has to make it sound like there is a military accomplishment. And I think also, you know, people in Iraq want to feel like there has been some you know, there has been enough effort done to eradicate ISIS, because obviously you're going through, a period of serious, you know, post-conflict stress and tense, because the amount of people who have suffered so gravely under the hands of ISIS, so at least that they can feel a little bit secure at this point. But I think it's a gross overstatement to say that ISIS is gone from Iraq. And actually, we had Vladimir Putin saying ISIS is gone from Syria. And, you know, that's just completely untrue, seeing as Syria is a complete basket case and there's no way you could interpret who's there and who's not at this point. So, I mean, I suppose what you could say, there is a win. The caliphate no longer exists in the way that it did. That has been a military achievement. At what cost, we don't know, because they really haven't been taking a lot of records about the civilian deaths and civilian casualties, because it was, you know, an extremely aggressive, belligerent counter-terrorism offensive there. Maybe that's what had to happen. The collateral damage is untold.
The fact that there isn't a physical presence for ISIS anymore, does that put Europe and perhaps the United States in more danger, though?
See, that's the thing. You know, they don't have the responsibility of a state anymore. And a lot of them actually were, when it came to the offensive in Raqqa, we saw videos. Quentin Somerville from the BBC did this amazing investigation where a lot of the guys were actually being led out by the Russian troops rather than being arrested, whereas in Iraq, any ISIS guys, they were severely bound, killed or sent to prison, whereas in Syria they actually were let out. So we know that a lot of those militants still are in existence, often probably trying to come back to the UK or their countries in some way or form. And definitely, they're sort of footloose now and they can engage in much greater attacks. And even if they weren't sort of operating, if they weren't orchestrating attacks from, let's say, the Turkey-Syria border, we still have these lone wolf types who are still inspired by the Islamic State, who will still be, on the internet, looking at videos and being brainwashed in that way, and then we'll probably see the need to go out and engage in attacks themselves. So the problem is not over. But I think the strong ones that are left behind, the militants that are who are experts in bomb making, in guerrilla warfare, those are the people that we need to look out for. And I don't think for one stretch Europe is free from terror attacks.
Yeah, we do have to take a break now, but we'll have more stories to review over the past year with Amy and Shona back in a couple of minutes. Welcome back. You are listening to The Moncrief Show on News Talk 106 to 108. Meanwhile, back to Hollywood. La La Land, it turned out, didn't win the Oscar, even if they thought they had for about 3 minutes.
Yeah, so back in February, there was kind of a bit of a battle between La La Land and Moonlight. They were both received as the front runners, but La La Land had won most of the kind of precursor awards, and it came down to the last awards of the night. Faye Dunaway, Warren Beatty are up there, giving their little preamble. Warren Beatty opens the envelope, kind of looks at it funny for a minute, and then Faye Dunaway gets a bit impatient and announces that Best Picture goes to La La Land. So, you know, everyone's up on stage, all the producers, Emma Stone, speeches are being given, everyone's like, you know, patting each other in the back. And then suddenly you see all these men run on stage and they're looking at the envelopes, you know, thing like, that's not what happened here. And then the revelation comes out that actually Moonlight won Best Picture, and you know, everyone in the audience is completely gobsmacked, doesn't know what's going on, doesn't know if it's a bit of a prank, because I remember I was covering it at the time. I was working in dailyedge.ie and I was watching it live in the office on my own at like 5 a.m. and I was like, is this a prank? Is this like Jimmy Kimmel doing some kind of like elaborate joke or something? And it went on for about 8 minutes, and you know, anyway, the Moonlight crowd came up on stage, they accepted the award. Warren Beatty had to clarify that he wasn't, you know, messing around, that the envelope had said Emma Stone La La Land. That's why it was read out that way. But it was really heartwarming kind of story in a funny way. It was such a farce, but it was really nice to see an underdog almost triumph. I feel like, you know, like the very small film, Moonlight is a beautiful film actually, but it's a very small film about an African American guy, as he kind of comes into his sexuality, is told in three parts, whereas La La Land is this big bombastic musical, and for that to kind of triumph over it, it was really, really nice and refreshing. And it was kind of, it was a few weeks after the inauguration, and it kind of made you wish, like, maybe.
So what happened anyway?
It was the wrong envelope was handed out. So
Price, why did they have them in an envelope in the first place?
So Price Waterhouse Cooper afterwards were told they will never have that gig again.
We made one mistake.
Yeah, I wasn't that gone on La La Land anyway.
I wasn't either. Wasn't into it.
It's like one of those you can Me Too campaigns. Yeah. You can say it now. At the time, you couldn't.
I didn't think.
Back to Europe now, and. Macron beat Le Pen, obviously, in that election. But in Austria, they're finding, you know, they have made an accommodation with the far right party. Is this, do you think, Shona, going to be the face of European politics? Now, there's going to be that far right component in coalition governments around
Europe.
That's
the question. I just don't know where how to feel about this, because, you know, we were talking about, I mean, the EU has been triumphant in saying, you know, the Marine Le Pen didn't win in France, and in the Netherlands, Geert Wilders didn't win either. And yes, AfD did well in Germany, but Angela Merkel is doing her best to ensure that they aren't going to be part of any new coalition. And the consensus, I thought, was that every European country does their best to ensure the far right, no matter how popular they become, don't get into power. And then our own Taoiseach tweeted Sebastian Kurz, new Chancellor of Austria, who's not from the Freedom Party, but the other coalition partner, to congratulate him. Well, he's just gone into coalition with the far right party that was actually built up by a few remaining Nazis. And so they have a direct link to Nazism. And if you look at some of their, the contradiction is just, it's quite stomach churning. Because if you look at some of their policies as well, you know, one of the things that Taoiseach said even last week in Brussels was that the EU needs to move away from putting out fires when it comes to the economic crisis, and now dealing with European citizens. Welfare reform in the most positive sense. You know, employment rights. The EU, you know, for citizens. And yet you have this party whose one of its mandates is to, you know, take money off refugees who have already sort of accessed to being members of society. You know, they're allowed work now, and they've reduced their payment, their welfare payment. But how is that something that's sort of socialist and something that you can get behind? And so how are we supposed to deal with it? How are we supposed to celebrate it? And is it a precedent now that, you know, maybe in the next election come round, or the European elections, we do allow Nazi parties to become part of the establishment because the Austrians have done it? And I mean, there's the other way you look at it, and you could say, well, maybe we're bringing them into the centre. And that could be a positive way, because, you know, what they've said is, you know, they're going to be, because the Freedom Party wanted to take Austria out of the EU, and that policy has been abandoned. So their sort of headline is this is going to be a pro-EU government. Well, it remains to be seen if that's going to be so. They've taken the Interior Ministry, and they've also taken Foreign Affairs and Defence, and they're kind of hardline portfolios for a party, as I said, built on the ashes of Nazis.
Yeah. Now, I suppose not a part of the reason why we're seeing these rise in these kind of parties to do with immigration, to do with worries about terrorism. Obviously, the Manchester bombing was an example of that. But then after that came the One Love concert.
Yeah, so the One Love concert was a massive benefit, hosted and organised by Ariana Grande. Ariana Grande, of course, had been playing a concert in the Manchester Evening News Arena when there was a bombing and 23 people lost their lives. And it was really, again, a really beautiful sort of, just a really beautiful gesture from her, because she's only 23, you know, don't forget that. And she managed to kind of summon all this compassion and, you know, went back to the city 2 weeks after this horrific thing. You know, you wouldn't have blamed her for retreating from the spotlight at all, but she came back and she did this beautiful thing for the city, and it was a really amazing benefit concert. So you had the likes of Coldplay, you had Liam Gallagher, you had Niall Horan, Miley Cyrus, and it was just a really beautiful thing. You know, you had kids and adults alike, people from all sorts of backgrounds unifying and singing along to, you know, songs like, you know, Live Forever and Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And it was a really beautiful thing to emerge from a very horrible thing. And I think it brought people together in a way when I think others were maybe trying to divide people. You know, there was a big conversation about immigration and about Muslims, and I think this actually brought people together, and it kind of shows what a unifying force pop music is, I think.
Another issue, I suppose, that touches on, or another event of the year that touches on similar issues, is the release of Ibrahim Halawa after a very long wait.
Yeah, I think it's about 1,500 days in prison, 2013 in August, and he was arrested after attending a political rally against the coup by Mohammed al-Sisi. Then him and his sisters, as we know, were arrested. They were released subsequently, and he spent 1,500 days in prison. And this was, you know, it was just a horror show to watch because of the unreliable nature of the justice system in Egypt, where you have where every time there was when his case came up for trial, he was part of a trial of nearly 500 people. So it means that it was calamitous because you'd have to have everyone sort of, you know, correct and present when, you know, unfortunately they were also being kept in these terrible prisons. So many were sick. And the worrying element was that some of the charges were relating to terrorism and could have resulted in the death penalty. So you had this serious waiting time as well to see, will he be given such either a long sentence or the death penalty. And so a lot of the last, you know, few years have been about whether or not the Irish government's diplomatic efforts were strong enough, whether they were resolute enough to actually want to get him released in prison. Were they tippy-toeing too much over the Egyptians and not sort of demanding of them to engage in proper standards of international law and do away with these mass trials? And obviously it was a terrible time for his family because they were worried sick. We heard throughout the period, we got letters from him from prison where he talked about the horrific things that he'd seen, the cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment he'd suffered when you're living in a tiny cell with, you know, with lice and cockroaches and hearing other people tortured and, you know, and so it was just a really, really awful time. And it has material, it all sort of came to an end just recently when he was released from prison, and it's a positive time for him and his family. And I suppose I'm sure he has to go through, you know, a serious amount of therapy. And I think one of the sadder elements as well is the Irish people who didn't think he should be a priority for the government or for the European Union, because the European Parliament, the European Union, the UN got involved in the end, because first of all, he wasn't even Irish, even though that's nonsense because he was born in Dublin, went to school in an Opus Dei school in Blackrock. So, you know, but there was always these questions about whether or not he himself was engaging in terrorism or if his father was a terrorist. And even if it's not that his father was, but, you know.
But there are connections, family connections with the Muslim Brotherhood.
Exactly. And that should be questioned, and those things should, and his father should be questioned about that, because we do also need to know that information and just have that information disclosed about who's in the country and what groups they belong to. There's no, I don't think there's a problem with that, but it's when you don't want to hear the truth or the facts and you accuse him or belittle his case because of possible connections to his father, which we don't know the facts of. That's a problem. And then, you know, you had people saying, sure, what was he doing there in the first place? Well, he was in Egypt, but we believe in freedom of assembly in this country. Does that mean he gets to go have to be in a mass trial of 500 people and suffer cruel and degrading treatment? I don't think so. So, you know, there was a lot of layers to it, but I think it's good for him now. He can, you know, settle at home with his family.
Now, Robert Kelly, this is the BBC dad, became the most famous dad in the world for a brief period of time. I don't know if he was necessarily that happy about it.
He didn't seem that happy about it. But yeah, for like, what was it, maybe 2 or 3 days, they were the most famous family in the world. So this was Robert Kelly. He was he's an American academic who lives in South Korea. And he was on BBC News one day talking about, I think it was the South Korean election and what happened next. I think everyone has seen it. But first of all, his little daughter Marion comes crashing through the door, just kind of striding in like, you know, the Queen of Sheba. Then this other child, this baby, comes crashing in on like a little space hopper kind of thing, and then the mum comes in on her hands and knees trying to.
So that was interesting at the time. A lot of people assumed she was the childminder,
problematic in and of itself. But it was a real kind of like, it was a perfect, you couldn't describe it. It was a perfect comedy moment. Yeah, it was almost like the rule of three that they always talk about in comedy, where you had like first Marion, then the baby, then the wife. But yeah, I mean, I think it was such a gloomy year. I think when this happened, people were just so happy to rally around something so just like silly and ludicrous and kind of harmless. But I mean, like, they had to have a press conference. You know, it was like truly, they were like an actual global sensation. But I think, yeah, it was one of those moments that I think everyone just really enjoys just for the sheer insanity of it.
Well, it wasn't all bad news. They're letting women drive now in Saudi Arabia.
Oh, yeah,
so,
course,
you know,
yeah.
Problem solved there.
Yes, that's it. Exactly. I mean, that's probably, do you think it was because of the Me Too movement?
Sure it was.
So he said, I'm here, hold on a minute. Yeah, this wife's seen stuff, I've had enough of it, we're going to change our laws. But it's about the Saudi Arabia becoming a more open economy. And so it's by force rather than a decision, you know, that, okay, we do recognise that women are equal. You know, it's because The Saudis, we know they had this amazing national reserve of oil, and that's where they've got a lot of their wealth. But the price of oil has gone down, and they need to open the private sector much more, and that means engaging better in Western multinationals, allowing Westerners or Western ideology creep a little bit into Saudi Arabia. So not only are women allowed to drive, they've reopened cinemas. Cinemas are going to be open across Saudi Arabia as of next year as well.
And they've arrested a lot of people for alleged bribe, corruption as well.
Yeah, that was Mohammed, you'll be hearing a lot of about
yes,
MBS.
Yeah, he's the young,
so Mohammed
groovy one.
Bin
yeah.
Salman is the crown prince, who's the son of King Salman now, and he's a 32-year-old man, and he's driving this so-called reform. Yeah, he was the one who had those members of his father's government arrested and holed up in the Ritz-Carlton.
The squalor of a five-star hotel. Yeah.
So I think they're actually still there. But it's an interesting thing, actually, just observing it as well, because the Saudis realised, under Barack Obama, Obama looked at Iran and thought, let's bring Iran into the mainstream, into the fold as no longer a pariah state, but a country that we can eventually work with. And let's pivot away from this relying on Saudi Arabia. The Saudi Arabians do not want to engage when it comes to women's rights or any of the principles that we hold dearly as the free world. Mm. So he decided to pivot towards Iran, and the Iran deal was part of that. And then it was just, when you had new leaders, you got rid of Ahmadinejad, you had Khomeini in Iran, and the Saudis realised, well, okay, this is we need to start moving on it. So it's about a much broader policy led by MBS, who we're going to be hearing a lot about over the next while. And so yeah, we'll just see how it evolves. I think it's going to be quite interesting. I know we had a conference there in Saudi Arabia last month. He invited all the heads of Facebook, the multi. Actually, just he could be a competitor to us now.
Yeah,
they start lowering their corporate tax rate and then copying the IDA.
Oh,
but
dear.
Yeah, it's an interesting move.
And Prince Harry, Meghan Markle, anyone care?
Well, I'm loathe to get excited about a royal wedding as well. But what I do enjoy about this story is just how it almost is like one of those made for TV kind of Christmas movies, like those awful things you see on like the Hallmark Channel, like an actress, like an African-American actress meeting a prince and them falling in
divorcee,
making it into the royal family. I just enjoy the kind of the optics of it. I really enjoy the thought of, her rocking up and meeting the queen, and then like people explain to the queen, oh yeah, this is Meghan Markle, she's in the show Suits. I don't know if you've seen it, but no, I'm loathe to get excited about it, but I do think they seem like a very nice, genuine couple. I think she's quite an impressive woman herself. She's a humanitarian. She's done a lot of kind of philanthropic work over the last couple of years. So I'm a little bit excited about it. I think in a world of doom and gloom, I can get excited about a royal wedding.
Though I did see on Twitter it's going to clash with the Corrifin Sheep Shearing Festival in Connemara.
Yeah.
So I'm torn.
Which one are you going to cover?
I know.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Who knows? Seán Murray and Amy O'Connor, thank you both very much.
Thanks, Sean.
Moncrief on News Talk
with Gas Networks Ireland. Natural gas is compatible with a wide range of modern appliances. gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.